Welcome to We Make Children's Books, the podcast that takes you through the imaginative minds of children's book authors and artists. I am your host, Barney Smith of StoryComic.com, and in today's episode, we are excited to have with us the author and illustrator of the two children's books, Coco La Swish, A Fish from a Different Rainbow, and Coco La Swish, When Rainbows Go Blue, Reagan Jackson. So before we get started, I want everybody to kind of get to know you a little bit and just kind of give everybody a bit of background on how you got into writing some of your poetry and some of your children's books.
I knew I wanted to be a writer before I could actually read. And so that was like, that's the story that my mom tells, is like that all of the things that were supposed to, all the things that she read about kids, we're like, oh, if you read to your kids, it's going to encourage them to want to read and it's going to encourage them to, you know, do all this stuff. But for me, like, I don't like redundancy. So since she was a person who read to me, I just assumed that that's how life was going to be for the rest of our lives. And like, she was the reader and I was the recipient of her reading, you know, like, and that was enough. And she was like, no, like, I need you to learn how to read. And I was real like uninterested because I'm like, why would I do that? You already know how to read. Like, she told me, well, if you want to become a writer, you have to learn how to read because that's the thing that writers know how to do. So I was like, oh, okay, well, I'm already a writer, so I'll learn how to read. I wrote several novels when I was a kid that will never be published because they're, you know, me still trying to figure out how to like write novels. And then I became really interested in poetry because it was so much shorter and so much more manageable. the novels. So I was like, oh yeah, I love this. I can finish a poem. Like, novels take forever. say about 2008, I went to the Seattle Poetry Slam and fell in love with slam poetry. During that whole year, I decided I was going to go to the slam at least once a month. And so by the end of the year, I had a book. It was not my intention to write a book. It was literally just my intention to write a poem and win the slam. Which I didn't do until way later. You know, since I've been that person who has, like, I've been carrying around a notebook since I was a kid, my mom was like, are you ever gonna, like, do anything with all this writing? Like, I put it all together, and that was Scott Hare, Love in America, my first book of poetry. It was literally just a gift for my mom for Christmas. And I ran into a friend who was into self-publishing, and so she like was like, oh, I just taught a tutorial on this. Like, let me sit you down and we'll just like do this together. And so she walked me through that process and I loved it because I got to make all of the decisions about, you know, the cover, the page numbers, or, you know, like just how to, like, how does the formatting look or what kind of graphics or, you know, things like that. And I always thought that I would go mainstream and then someone would be like making most of those decisions for me and I would just have to like suck it up if I didn't like it. And so it felt really empowering to be like, no, like, I don't think that this book is going to sell a whole bunch of copies, but I'm going to do it exactly the way I want it. So, you know, I know whoever is reading it is reading what I intended.
Mm-hmm. Is that your art on the cover?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, all of it. So okay. The cover, and then inside there's like a couple of like little graphics and stuff, and I did all of that too.
And so you came out with, so that was your first book, God, Hair, Love in America. Your second, because you also have two other books of poetry that you put out, Love in Guatemala and Summoning Unicorns. What, did you have them come out after or before your children's books?
I think it went God, Hair, Love in America, then Coco La Swish 1, then Summoning Unicorns, then Coco La Swish 2. Mm-hmm. And then somewhere in between there, I also did an anthology called GV the Poetry.
With, oh, wow.
So with the second one, basically, like, when I finished the first book, which was God, Hair, Love in America, of course, as I'm, like, in this process, I'm still writing. And so it's, like, kind of this, like, when is the cutoff? Like, I'm like, oh, I just wrote three really good poems. Like, I want them to be in that book that I just published and I can't take it back. So I was like, okay, well, maybe that's, you know, seeds for the next book. And then with Coco La Swish, I wrote this as a poem when I was teaching. I used to teach fourth and fifth grade Spanish at Meridian School. And as a part of, like, being in community with kids, like, we'd have, like, a Friday morning assembly, like, Friday morning meetings. And what I was noticing is that there are a lot of kids who were being kind of ostracized for being different. I wrote it as a poem and I shared it at an assembly just to youth and their parents. And one of the parents afterwards, like with tears in her eyes, came up to me and was like, "You need to make this into a children's book." And I was like, "Yeah, yeah, sure." but also like had no idea how to do that. It's funny because it took me like, I don't know, a couple hours to write the poem and then 5 years to figure out how to turn it into a book. Because I was really self-conscious about my art, honestly. And I was looking for somebody to illustrate it for me. I didn't want to be the one to do that. And I just didn't find the right person. It just wasn't coming together until finally I was like, okay, I guess I'm just going to do this.
And I did notice that when I was telling you before we went on the air that I did read Coco Le Swish. To my, I can say it, Coco Le Swish. Reading it is easy, but saying Le Swish is hard. Okay. There was a cadence to it. There was a really good rhythm to it. It flowed. It was poetry. And what I love about your illustrations that you put into it, as you say, it's collage and painting on there, that it is immediately, recognizable and relatable to children, completely reminiscent of going into an elementary school art classroom to see that. And so I would say the difference between poetry and children's book is that with a children's book's model, you have to have a message at the end that a child can relate to. So what would you say that you mentioned is your two books? So what was the messaging that you put in behind there?
Ooh, well, for Coco Le Swish, A Fish from a Different Rainbow, the first one, the message was just, it's okay to be who you are, period. Whoever you are, if you have like, you know, fabulous rainbow scales, if you have like a swishy tail, like it's cool. Like, and it just addresses like hater fish specifically, because that's a real experience, not just, you know, in life, but especially in school. Like, I watch little kids ostracize other little kids. And I was like, I can't believe how early this is all happening. And, you know, there's only so much intervention that I think adults can actually do. At a certain point, this is kind of a universal experience and all youth, I think, are going to have to deal with it. And at a certain point, they're going to need to have that develop some inner strength. I do think you have to like look at both books because I leveled up in terms of my illustrations for the second one. I think it helped, like, you know, to have more of a sense of like, oh, okay, this is what it can be. But yeah, Coco Le Swish When Rainbows Go Blue was about the fact that in most school situations, when you ask kids how they are, there's like two responses. You're either I'm fine or I'm good. Like, those are the two things that you can be. And anything outside of that is pulling focus from the class. So like your rage, your sadness, your depression, your exuberance, like schools don't want that. I found that to be incredibly challenging. It was counterintuitive for me working as an educator. Like I wanted to know how kids really were. And when I made the space for that, you know, I felt like that's when we were making a lot of connections. Because of the way that our systems are set up, there are not a lot of people who are making space for that. And so sometimes kids who are particularly emotional think that they're crazy or just repress and repress and repress, and then it comes out in like really inappropriate and in awful ways. So I wanted to tell the story of someone who wasn't okay. Like, so, you know, Coco becomes both physically and metaphorically blue. and then kind of goes about trying to solve the problem of what do you do when you're sad? And sometimes there's not like a really clear solution.
What would you say is the kind of the age range for Coco Le Swish?
I had my librarian friend categorize that because I actually don't know. I'm like that adult that's like watching cartoons and stuff. So I'm like, it's every age. So if you can read this. But I think it's like second grade, something like that, second or third grade.
Well, you know, what's the hidden message behind the fact that Cocolus Wish has to go to people older than her to ask how to fix this? And then in the end, it turns out that, well, I don't want to give away the end. Never mind.
There we go. Spoiler alert. And thinking through Coco's journey, I thought about, like, what are the things that you do when you're problem solving? And for a lot of, like, young people, it is going to your elders or, like, that, you know, these are the resources. But I like the idea, too, of the fact that, like, the elders sometimes were helpful and sometimes were not. You know, like.
Why did you decide that you needed to make a sequel? And two, how did you script that out?
Granted, the writing for the second book, I think, took way longer than the writing for the first book that I didn't know was going to be a book. So that's one thing. It's like, you kind of have to get over your own self-consciousness at a certain point and just, like, actually write. The ideas in the same way as the first book just came through kids, like watching them, watching their behavior, watching how they interact, and trying to use my use storytelling as a way to connect with them or to get them to think through more deeply these different issues. So, like, in my mind, this is actually all, like, I think that Cocolus Wish will have a third book, and then that'll be the completion of the series. In my mind, I see it already. It's like in yellow, and it's Cocolus Wish, a bird and a fish.
Oh. And,
yeah, it's, you know, it's about relationships. But in terms of, like, the actual process, because the first one was a poem and I wrote it in verse and I wrote it with rhyme, I wanted to do that with the second one as well. But it was a lot longer, you know, like the story is just a lot longer. So I was like, can I really, like, rhyme this whole time? Yes, it turns out I can. What I did with the first one was I put it in a Word document and I separated out the pages, because of course, when you just write it, it's all in a block, it's all in a brick. Like, so you have to, like, read through and just figure out, like, how much text is okay on one page. And then once you decide that, you can decide, like, okay, well, what's the picture to that text? So actually there's a book that this is so funny. There's a book in between these two books, which is actually, it's the same text from Cocolus Wish, A Fish from a Rainbow. I met this tattoo artist who I love, who read Cocolus Wish and loved it so much. He drew a picture of Coco, and that was like a hybrid of Coco and his daughter, like a little portrait. And I loved it so much, I decided to work with him to do a second version of Cocolus Wish, which is a coloring book, an activity pack with, like, a crossword and a word find. It's just so much fun. So working with him as well, like, I just had to, like, break it down step by step. So it also, like, it helped me to do a lot of tester drawings.
So you sat down, so you separated it all out into different pages. Mm-hmm. And did you then, from there, did you kind of sketch out on what you wanted the image to look like?
I don't do rough drafts in that way. Like, I just go for it. So, like, once I know, like, okay, this I'm doing a picture for this painting or for this set of text, I got paper that was the size of the book that I wanted. I wanted 8x8. And I just did them like that. And then I, like, scanned them in.
And how long did it take you to create all those pieces of art, basically?
Oh my gosh, it took forever. It was so long. I would say it was maybe like a month and a half doing this. Because once I'm, like, in it, once I'm in the process, like, I get really super focused, you know? So I'll be, like, late into the night, like, working on these paintings. And
so you had these paintings, you scanned them into your computer, had them laid out. Somebody who's watching or listening would say, all right, I got that. I'm ready to go. I have no idea what to do. I have something together. How do I actually hold this book in my hands?
I used a service that's no longer technically in existence called CreateSpace.
Okay. It's Kindle Direct now.
Right. Yeah, Kindle Direct. So I don't know if it's still as user-friendly as it was. Once you made a free account, you could look at different book sizes, because that was a thing too, was like, and that's a thing to note. If you're working on self-publishing a book, you want to make sure that you are able to publish in a way that if a library wants it or if a bookstore wants to sell it, like it's not a weird size or difficult to print. So they had several like blank templates that also helped with sizing things. So I went in, I like downloaded the blank template for the 8x8 book. And then I was like, okay. So then I like transferred what I had done in my little Word document into the one that actually fits the size, you know? So definitely like little nitpicky things like that are really helpful. I'm a big fan of editors. So it's really helpful, I think, if you have somebody else look at the work and line up, you know, like once your eyes are blurry and you can't see like that things are out of whack, like somebody else can like help you with.
So did you have a friend help you with that editing part?
Yeah, my friend Lori, she's actually been, I want to say, the first reader for every book except for the last three that I just wrote this year. In addition to like doing all this writing and doing all this other stuff, like a couple of things. One, I'm also an award-winning journalist. So, you know, in my other like 5 minutes a day, this whole time, like from about 2013 on, I was writing a regular column. And what I've noticed in terms of the uses of my writing is that a lot of it is a catharsis. And it's something that I'm doing it to process something, or I want to communicate a very specific thing. And then with my art, it's just like a meditation. It is very joyous and I just sit. And so I had a friend who had been reading my writing, like my very serious writing, and then came to my art show and was like, what is this? Like, cause it's like all these colors and like bubbles and da da da. And like, for him, it was really difficult for him to square my personality. Cause he's like, I'm used to you being like the angry Reagan or like the precise da 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 Reagan. I'm not used to this like fluffy side. And so with Summoning Unicorns, I feel like it was my first attempt at being a bit more balanced. So I have intentionally, like I wrote poems when I was really happy and joyous or excited or goofy, or, you know, like I wanted to have more of a full range.
And so that was basically, so Summoning Unicorns is would you say more of like a lighter collection of poetry?
Funny, yes and no. I think it's I just think it's a more balanced.
And then you also have Emerald Reflections is another anthology that you have some poetry in.
Yeah, I forgot about that. There was two of those. and I'm in both of them. And then there's another one that same journalist Marcus Harrison Green put out called Flight of the Assemblies.
So talk about the time. How do you find the time or in the energy? Because there has to be like a substantial amount of energy to kind of close things off and sit down and start writing.
Yeah. Well, a couple of things. One is I am not, I don't write every single day. I felt at times like shamed by other writers who were like, I write every day. And I want to like say that that's great if you do write every day, like much respect to you. And if you're a person who can't do that for whatever reason, or you just don't have it in you at that moment, that's okay. And that doesn't mean that you're not a writer. Like for many years, I was a writer that didn't write. Like a couple of things happen. One is like the inspiration hits and the idea is so good that I follow that. I just, what I do. Last week I like launched a 60-person summer camp. I like started this like big healing circle thing or whatever, but I also wrote 3,000 words because there was a story that I wanted to tell, or I wanted to process with folks. And it just was like, I woke up in the middle of the night, it was like 4 a.m. It's like it was writing itself. So I was just like, well, I just get up and do what I can do. And then by midday, I had my first draft. I find it comforting to write.
So how do you usually sit down in front of a computer, or are you scratch it out on notepads? Do you have post-it notes all over the place, or do you just have that one laptop or that one computer you open up and put it out there like that?
Yep, just open up my computer and go. If I'm like, sometimes for shorter things, like for poetry or whatever, I might take a notebook and go someplace in nature. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, I'm like at some kitchen table somewhere, my kitchen or someone else's kitchen. I don't know why a kitchen is a good place to write, but it is.
Is there any types of programs that you recommend for writers to use, like any outlining programs or any type of just Word document?
Yeah, I'm super basic on stuff like that. I don't do anything. I like, y'all can recommend something to me, like, but I'll be in this Word document, like it's 1997.
What are some of the advice and recommendations that you would give to writers who are starting to write? What are some of the things that you wished you knew, you know, 10 years ago before you started?
Just start where you are and do what you can. A lot of my biggest roadblocks have been self-inflicted. I have to just kind of let it go. Like, no. And if I spend all my time like comparing myself to other people and their genius, like, I'm never going to actually figure out what mine is. The more you write, the easier it becomes. Definitely read when you write and read in the genres that you're writing in, because I feel like that is really helpful, just to soak in the cadence of how language works. Like, you have to read as much as you write, I think, in order to be any good at it. Just taking the pressure off, like, sometimes you can just write and it doesn't have to be good. Like, it just is. And drafts. Like, I love drafts, because if you messed it up the first time, you can fix it. But if you don't do it the first time, then you have nothing to fix. Like, you don't even have anything to work with. Like, so the most important part is just to do it. It's just to write.
When you were writing the children's books, what were some of the books that you were reading at the time that you used that helped inspire you?
I went back into the box of my old children's books. You know, like, I have like boxes of books that my mom gave, and like, it's interesting to like look at your old stuff. One, it just kind of gave me so much more. I feel like my relationship with my parents has improved dramatically as I've become an adult, because I can see like how much care they put into everything that they gave me. Like, even in the books, like, I have like Ezra Jack Keats, Pet Shop, and The Snowy, Snowy Day is really beautiful. And one called Arrow to the Sun, which is probably like in the like 0.1% of books that are children's books that cover like Native American culture. You know, like, I don't actually know where my mom found these books, but there's like, when I was looking at them, all of the art is so completely different from one another that kind of gave me more courage to be like, oh, I don't actually like, there isn't one way to do this thing. I can do it the way I want to do it. And that's a valid expression.
And what about like your books of poetry? What are some of your favorite inspirational poets that you like to read?
Ooh, Mindy Netafee, Rise of the Trust Fall. It really was a game changer for me. And then Chisala Upile's Soft Magic. Anastasia Renee's Forget It. I really love that one. And my godfather gave me a copy of 3,000 Years of Black Poetry. And it's an anthology, and it has like a lot of like Langston Hughes and Gwendolyn Brooks. And, you know, like, so I don't know. I've been reading poetry for a long time.
Yeah. And so what's coming up next then? You showed us the book that was just published, and you mentioned that you're working on a third Cocoa La Swish. How is that coming along?
There's certain things that pull me sooner than others, so I think that third book is going to take a while. But this year I did a book, it's called Still Here. But yeah, Still Here, a South End mixtape from an unexpected journalist. So that's like it's a part memoir of my experience as a journalist, and then mixed with an anthology of some of my articles. Yeah, if you want, I'll read you like the first couple of pages of Still Here.
Yes, let's hear it.
Okay. I have long felt the crushing weight of the strange paradox of being both invisible and hypervisible as a Black woman in America. The need to process my experiences has kept me coming back to writing. Though I have been a writer for the majority of my life, I didn't see a place for myself in journalism. In the early 1900s, W.E.B. Du Bois wrote about the theory of double consciousness in his book, The Souls of Black Folk. He posited that being Black and being American is to look at the world with two understandings, that of the white mainstream lens and that of our own cultural perspective. It is this double consciousness that made me skeptical and critical of journalism for the ways it has been used as a tool of systemic oppression to vilify and misrepresent people of color. But it is also what positioned me well to become a counter-narrative. I was introduced to Sarah Studeville, Jessica Partnow, and Alex Stonehill, the co-founders of the Seattle Globalist, in 2013. We met over brunch at the home of my friend, media justice activist Sabrina Roach. Sabrina introduced me as a person who liked to write and someone passionate about study abroad. I fell into a rant about the ways in which people of color are excluded from study abroad programs and how the white solution is to mistake color for economic status and throw money at the problem. Yes, money is sometimes one obstacle that people of color face in making the decision to study abroad, but we are always making a way out of no way, finding scholarships, hosting spaghetti dinners, or circulating GoFundMe pages. The challenges that go unmentioned are the fact that many of these programs were not designed with us in mind. I told the story of the Black girl who went to South Africa on a study abroad program only to arrive at a white homestay with a family that had a dog that was trained to bite Black people. There is a global misconception often perpetuated by white media that the US is still a white country. Still, what kind of negligence exists that a university would send a student to an unsafe environment? What if that student had been white? Would it have been acceptable for them to stay in a home with people who harbored such hatred? What would they have learned about South Africa? I shared my own experience of being Black in Spain on a predominantly white program and the microaggressions I experienced both in the group of my peers and in the host country itself. Alex turned to me and said, "That sounds interesting. You should write about it." I had unwittingly pitched my first story. I went home, wrote a couple of pages, and emailed it to him. To my surprise, he published it with minimal edits and sent me a check. Like millions of people, I had a blog. I was also a contributor to the Black Girl Nerds blog. I had written two articles in high school, one that published in the Madison Times and the other in the Capital Times. But the process never felt quite so official. After my first article, I followed up with another, and within a few months, they offered me a column. When I told my dad I was going to be a reporter, the first thing he said was, "Don't be that asshole who sticks the microphone in the face of the person who just lost their kid." His words challenged me to think critically about the role of journalist. We tell the facts. We report what happened, but so much of what has been written about my community has been narrated by people from outside of it, with no context to understand the facts, enough to even articulate the full truth. I wanted to tell stories from my community, but never at their expense. Through years of conditioning by white media, we have been taught that journalism is sensational, concise, and didactic, and should be narrated without emotion or bias. That is not who I wanted to be or how I wanted to write. I needed to create a new paradigm of ethics. I have biases, lots of them, and opinions and perspectives, and I didn't want to leave them out, but rather use them to reframe the news. I wanted to tell more complete stories, to create a space for nuance and balance, authenticity and perspective. Could I do this? Could I be the journalist that didn't lose myself or my voice? There was no guarantee that this was possible. I had no roadmap. But the Globalist was new too, just barely 6 months off the ground. The PI had closed its doors. The Seattle Times seemed to be in decline, still is. The Stranger had gone from indie to establishment. Journalism as we knew it was dying, and standing at the funeral, suddenly there was an opportunity to right some wrongs, to stop begging for representation and trying to get a foothold into the mainstream. I took a chance. So it goes on from there, but I feel like that's enough. That book is coming out, I believe, in September. So okay. Yeah, we're just sending out the preview copies to folks to blurb the back.
So this was an exclusive then, having... You hear that?
By the first.
Yeah. Well.
Yeah. You're breaking news here.
They're breaking right here. Yeah. Where can people find you? Where can people find your work?
Oh, gosh. So my website is always under construction. So I'm hoping to have a better one soon. But in the meantime, it's REJJ Arts. Those are my initials. And then, yeah, you can buy my books at Barnes and Nobles or any other indie booksellers as well. Find me at the library.
And they have, you're under your book sections there. You actually have basically all your books there, and they have hyperlinks to it to buy them from there. That's right. So yeah, so check it out. So, and I'll put the link in the show notes as well for everybody, rejjarts.com. And through there, you can see her books. Also, they could probably, you know, as you say, find your books on Amazon or Barnes and Noble. And they'll do a search for Regan Jackson, and it'll pop up. So thank you very much, Regan. This has been a wonderful hour. And I'm all right. Well, thank you very much, Regan.
Thanks. Take care, Barney.
Party. There we go.
Yeah, can you just invite me to your watch party, and then that does that tag me?
Yeah, if you go to my Facebook page now, you'll see it.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, technology. What? What is this about?
What is this about?
Oh, snap. Hi. We are live. It's happening.
It's happening.
It's you and me. Sierra, are you on here yet? No.